People First Radio is a program about people, the society in which we live, and issues related to health and wellness.
It's how do we even talk about urgency after a decade?
When I was really heavy into the drug use, I just needed somebody to treat me like I was a real person.
I just think it's really unacceptable that this is happening and this continues to happen, and that five people a day are still dying from toxic drugs.
Welcome to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Tuesday, April 14th, marked the 10th anniversary of a declared public health emergency in British Columbia. Then Provincial Health Officer Dr. Perry Kendall called the emergency because of a significant increase in drug-related overdoses and deaths, according to the government's 2016 press release. 474 deaths in BC were attributed to illicit drug poisoning in 2015, the year before the emergency was declared. In the 10 years since, more than 18,000 people have died as a result of toxic drug poisoning in the province. Hundreds gathered in front of the legislature in Victoria Tuesday to mark the 10th anniversary of the emergency's declaration. That event had the dual themes of grief and rage. Among the speakers was Bernie Pauly. She's a scientist with the Canadian Institute for Substance Use Research. I spoke with her following Tuesday's event to try and take stock of what's happened in 10 years of this public health emergency.
Hi, I'm Dr. Bernie Pauly. I'm a professor of nursing at the University of Victoria, and I'm a scientist at the Canadian Institute for Substance Use Research. So I'm both a nurse and a researcher.
And we are having this conversation on the 10th anniversary of the declaration of a public health emergency in BC. What do you think people need to know about why that emergency was declared in 2016?
In 2016, the public health emergency was declared because the number of overdose deaths had increased. They had gone from about 200 a year, and they had jumped up, to 3 to 4 times that. And the importance of naming it and calling it a public health emergency was quite important because it acknowledged that we are in a state of emergency. A state of emergency that we're still in today, 10 years later, and with the hope of mobilizing action.
And so if we put ourselves back in time into the mindset of 2016, what were some of the things that maybe changed or caused circumstances to evolve such that there was something that would come out and be labeled a public health emergency?
Yeah, definitely. It was the shift in the volatility of the unregulated drug supply, where there were fentanyl and fentanyl analogs that were the leading cause of death and still are the leading cause of death. About 80% of unintentional toxic drug deaths in the province are due to unregulated fentanyl. That was really a shift in the drug market, and people weren't intending to overdose. It was absolutely a shift in the toxicity of the drug supply.
Now, a public health emergency, what did that mean in 2016? What does that mean? What kind of additional powers does that grant?
Yeah, declaring it a public health emergency, I think, I remember listening to the press conference when Dr. Perry Kendall announced it. And I remember feeling hopeful that this would allow some immediate kind of interventions and actions. And, it allowed some things. There was, better ability to actually know what the numbers were and what was going on. So data. I think a really important piece was the ability for naloxone to be distributed provincial-wide, and that it's available without a prescription. It's free. And I just want to highlight that doesn't and hasn't happened everywhere. You know, BC, and it was rolled out by people who use drugs, and that's a really important part of the story, because they, the province invested in drug user networks and peer networks so that there could be peer-to-peer distribution of naloxone. And that was a very planned implementation, and people, you know, were trained, they were able to train other people. That was a really important thing that happened early on. And then it also enabled the ability to provincially to be able to open overdose prevention sites. And I just want to kind of tell a bit of a story there, because there's really important kind of background. Supervised consumption sites are evidence-based harm reduction interventions. There's, like, you know, now probably over two decades of evidence about their effectiveness and in sort of immediately responding and to overdoses and saving lives and connecting people to treatment. So there's a lot of documented evidence, but they require, at the time, they were requiring federal approval. And there was, you know, quite a process that had to be gone through in order to get a supervised consumption site established. So in 2016, we really only had Insight was one of the main supervised consumption sites. They weren't distributed throughout the province. And Anne Livingston, who was with in the downtown east side, opened up an overdose prevention site, an unsanctioned one, and got the Minister Terry Lake at the time, to come and to visit the site and to see how, you know, it works to prevent overdose deaths and save lives. And what followed from that was the minister implementing what's called a ministerial order. And the ministerial order meant that overdose prevention sites could be started by communities throughout the province, and they didn't have to go through that federal process because they were evidence-based, they were, you know, effective for preventing overdoses, so an obvious kind of response to the emergency. And again, a lot of those sites were started by nonprofit organizations and involved people who use drugs. So they were set up in a way that they were accessible. They were less, maybe less clinical, more community-based. And you can kind of think of them as a novel and nimble evidence-based response. So that was significant that was able to happen. But, you know, we can, and those are interventions that are still, I mean, they're evidence-based interventions that are still important to the comprehensive response. But, you know, the drug market changed again in around 2020, 2021, with more benzodiazepines now in the drug supply. So naloxone's less effective.
Can I jump in there? Benzodiazepines in the drug supply. Can you give me a quick primer on what that means, what those are? And when you say benzodiazepines in the supply, I guess one part of the question is, like, what are benzodiazepines? What do they do? And then in the supply, what does that mean as far as the practical logistics for people who use drugs?
Yeah, so benzodiazepines are sedatives. And so they cause, you know, people to be more drowsy. They are not responsive. And they're added, when I say they're in the drug supply, what it means is that they've been added to things like fentanyl to help it to last longer, to the effect to last longer. And so what that means for some of the interventions, like overdose prevention site, it means that people are needing, have prolonged sedation, so they're needing to be observed longer. It also means that naloxone, you know, isn't going to be as effective because it's working in a different way. So the importance of the changes in the drug supply is it illustrates what we're really talking about as the problem, that it's an unregulated supply. There is no quality control. There's no people don't necessarily know what the composition of it is. And so it is going to change and evolve. And so when we think about how we're going to respond to this, we have to think about multiple interventions. And at the root of it, I know we're going to come to this later, I'm sure, but at the root of it, we have to think about how do we actually regulate that supply? Because we regulate food, we regulate water, we regulate alcohol. You know?
You're listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. So far on today's show, I've been speaking with Bernie Pauly of the Canadian Institute for Substance Use Research and the University of Victoria. We've been talking about the public health emergency around toxic drugs in BC. That emergency marked its 10th anniversary Tuesday, April 14th. We'll return to that conversation later on in the program. First, Stephanie Harrington and Amanda Farrell-Lowe have both lost brothers due to toxic drug poisoning. They co-facilitate a support group for others who have seen siblings die or be severely impacted by the crisis. On Tuesday, Farrell-Lowe and Harrington were in Victoria's Bay Centre at a space housing an art exhibition called Naming a Crisis that's commemorating those who have lost their lives to toxic drug poisoning. The pair were preparing signs to take to an event in front of the legislature later that afternoon. Farrell-Lowe took me through her thoughts as she was trying to craft her message.
Right now we're making some signs for the rally at 1, and I'm struggling a bit to fit everything I want to say on one piece of cardboard.
Well, what are some of the things you would want to say if that was the biggest piece of cardboard in the world?
I've been reflecting a lot on the past decade, and my daughter's 10th birthday is tomorrow, and she was born just a few hours after the public health emergency was declared. And so I think about how she's almost done elementary school, she's growing up, and this is the only reality she's known. She's grown up in this, and like, what do kids think about this? Is this still going to be an emergency when she graduates from high school? It's just pretty heavy to think about those two things side by side.
Is that something that you talk with your daughter about?
Yeah, a little bit. So I lost my brother to overdose in 2012, so a few years before the declaration was made. And so we talk about him, and she knows, you know, how he died, and, you know, we talk about it in terms that are, you know, age appropriate. But yeah, I mean, it's not a secret in our house, and we try to have open, honest conversations about these things with her. And yeah, it's still really hard, but we try to be honest, because secrecy and stigma is part of what kills people.
Stephanie, over here, I see you've been making some progress on your sign. You've already got the pencil layer is down. You're moving on to the next step. Could you tell me a little bit about the message you're going to be sharing?
My sign says, put the urgency in emergency, which is something I think a lot of people are feeling a lot of frustration with the EB government. Is just the lack of urgency in this crisis compared to other public health crises. And I think there's a lot of frustration, and I think the event at the ledge today is appropriately called In Grief and Rage, because I think when someone dies from a toxic drug related death, that there's a lot of stigma, and there's a lot of anger, really, at the lack of action on the behalf of government and the scaling back of initiatives that were actually working.
So given that context and the fact that this is a 10th anniversary of a health emergency being declared, what is the significance of that for you? How do you think about this day?
I just think it's really unacceptable that this is happening and this continues to happen, and that 5 people a day are still dying from toxic drugs, and that the government has had many expert groups and people with lived experience and people who have a lot of expertise in this area advising them on this issue, and they just continue to ignore the solutions that are being put towards them in terms of regulating or the in terms of managing the unregulated drug supply and having actually effective treatment options and decriminalization, all things that have been talked about by experts who know much more about the issue than I do, and the government should be listening to them.
And the first time the three of us spoke, it was actually about a support group that you two co-facilitate for people who have experienced the loss of siblings as part of this crisis. I'm wondering if Stephanie, you could tell me a little bit about finding some kind of solidarity or community over the course of this public health emergency, of this crisis.
For me, taking action in running a grief group and meeting other people who work in this area and trying to support their efforts is, I feel like, the least I can do after losing my brother. And it's important to me to kind of stand up for what I believe in. And I think, you meet a lot of other people in various harm reduction groups and in the community who are doing amazing work. And I want to be able to support them in what they're doing.
When will we know that the toxic drug crisis or the public health emergency has been addressed? What is the target?
When people stop dying. When this was considered serious enough to declare a public health emergency 10 years ago, we were on track for 800 people to die in 2016. That's directly from the press conference that Perry Kendall held 10 years ago. He said 800 people. It ended up being closer to 1,000. Now we're still at twice that, even though numbers have, technically gone down this past year. It's still double what it was when we considered this serious enough to declare a public health emergency, and that is completely unacceptable. I don't know what metric they're going to use to end this on the government level, but it can't be anywhere near where we are now.
Amanda Farrell-Lowe and Stephanie Harrington speaking with me in Victoria's Bay Centre at a space playing home to the exhibition Naming a Crisis. They were speaking with me ahead of a rally to mark the 10th anniversary of a public health emergency being declared in BC around toxic drug poisoning deaths.
This is People First Radio, coming to you on CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo, on CFMH Local 107.3 FM in St. John, and on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria.
Tuesday, April 14th, marked the 10th anniversary of a public health emergency being declared in British Columbia because of an increase in drug-related overdoses and deaths. Since that declaration, more than 18,000 people have died as a result of toxic drug poisoning, according to the Provincial Coroner Service, including more than 1,800 last year. Bernie Pauly is a nursing professor at UVic and a scientist with the Canadian Institute for Substance Use Research. I spoke with her Tuesday about how the crisis has unfolded in the decade since being labeled a public health emergency. When we talk about the drug supply, what does that look like for someone who uses drugs? Like, where and how do they acquire it? Who is supplying that? And what is the kind of oversight or government response to the situation, like, as is?
I mean, the response as is to criminalize substances. That's, we have in Canada a long history of prohibition, a choice that was made, over 100, almost 100 years ago, to criminalize certain forms of drug use. So then the response is often that we're going to criminalize someone for possession of substances, even if it's for personal use. And I think, it's important to recognize that that's kind of what plays out in kind of the way that drug policy gets made. Those kinds of things play out over and over again, and it gets very kind of politicized, you could say, because of a lack of regulation. And it means, I guess, the other thing I should say, when it's criminalized, it means that the drug policy decisions are also about investing in law enforcement and, you know, means of that's the means of control. And I think where harm reduction comes in is it's a very pragmatic approach. It, you know, harm reduction recognizes that drug use is something that has been, drugs have been used by people throughout history, and that, you know, the focus is on ensuring safer use. And we can think back to the days, you know, some of the early days of HIV, where, you know, the concern was about transmission of HIV. And so programs like clean needles and syringe programs came into play, recognizing that that was a way to prevent HIV. One of the things I think often gets forgotten, though, in harm reduction is that it's actually a lot more than that. It prevents disease in the case of needle and syringe programs, prevents overdose in the case of overdose prevention sites, but it does a lot more than that in terms of providing often a safe space for people to be able to talk to someone about drug use, to be able to connect to services. That's a really important part of harm reduction that kind of gets lost sometimes in there, because with criminalization, one of the big issues is people don't feel safe to talk about drug use. They don't feel safe to reach out to access services.
In the 10 years that this has been a declared public health emergency, can you walk me through how you have seen something like harm reduction be considered or evaluated by people making decisions about policy?
Yeah, so in British Columbia, official policy is that harm reduction is part of, you know, the policy choices and the response to, in this case, well, it's the response to overdose prevention. That would be considered the official policy, that the focus is on preventing harms of drug use, right? And it's not focusing on whether people use drugs or not. I just want to really highlight that. So, you know, I think some of those initial policy responses around the provincial naloxone program, the ministerial order around overdose prevention sites, they had very much an example of a harm reduction focus. I think where things, you know, the introduction and the idea of decriminalization was to take out and take away the stigma that's associated with criminalization. And decrim was meant to, and I just want to make sure that this is clear for everybody, decrim basically takes away the criminal sanctions for personal possession. It's different than regulating the supply. Regulating the supply means we would actually put in a set of quality controls. Decrim just means we're going to take away the criminal sanctions for personal possessions of substances. And I think it's really, that was something that was actually called for in 2016. It took till 2023 for the pilot to be approved. And as you know, the pilot was then retracted and not renewed in 2026. So, you know, we have a failed policy around decriminalization.
How do you evaluate that policy and what it did and what it was aiming to do and what kind of evidence there is around?
Yeah, so there's evidence from decrim in other countries and what's worked there. And one of those countries is Portugal, where they had a very high HIV rate. They had overdose deaths. And so they put into place a policy of decriminalization. And at the same time, they also put in increased access to harm reduction services and increased access and availability of housing and supports so that people had a place to go. And they weren't, there was an information, we also know and up from other countries that where DCRIM has been implemented, public information is really, really important. People need to understand what the objectives are of DCRIM. And they need to understand, you know, in municipalities, I think particularly in BC, municipalities needed to understand and support DCRIM because that's kind of critical to the whole project. Otherwise, it's too easy to just target and say, oh, there's drug use. That's because of DCRIM. There's always been drug use around, but it's an easy kind of target.
When you suggest that in Portugal there was decriminalization and alongside it there was an increased investment in housing for people and an increased investment in harm reduction, are you suggesting that those things did not accompany decriminalization here in BC?
There were not at that time, like 2023. I mean, you know, you're familiar, BC, most of BC is a very expensive place to live. You know, Victoria particularly is very expensive. You know, people are earning, maybe only making, getting a rent, you know, their income assistant might only cover $500 for rent, but we're looking at a place that might, you know, if you're going to rent in the market, you're looking at something that's going to cost $2,000 a month. So there aren't, you know, there was no additional efforts, attempts that were made to provide housing. So people didn't have a place to go. And, you know, we can sort of see how municipalities kind of picked up DCRIM to kind of blame that on the housing crisis.
Now, 10 years into this public health emergency, there are more people who died last year, for example, than when this was declared in the first place. You're talking there about a policy that was rolled out as a pilot project and then ended, wrapped up. Is there still momentum? Like, what does it mean that this is still a public health emergency from a policy level?
What it means that it's still a public health emergency is that we're nowhere near the levels of overdose deaths pre-calling of the emergency. You know, the number of people that died in 2025 was double what it was in 2016. And so we're still at a very high rate of death, about 4 to 5 people per day. So, we haven't yet implemented a comprehensive evidence-based approach. You know, in fact, we're going in the opposite direction. You know, we're seeing it becoming more, at times, more challenging for overdose prevention sites to be established and opened. We saw the DCRIM pilot ending. When it comes to prescribed safer supply, which was introduced in 2020, at the same time that COVID, that we had a declared public health emergency due to COVID, of course, the concern was is that this would exacerbate, and it did, the public health emergency due to unintentional overdoses. And so the provincial policy of safer supply was introduced. As an emergency measure.
Can you remind folks, what did that look like with a policy of prescribed safer supply? What did that mean in practice and look like for people?
What it meant was that physicians and nurse practitioners could prescribe opioids, some stimulants, and some other prescription drugs that had harm reduction goals with the attempt to separate people from the unregulated drug market so that they would have a prescription medication, which is a medication of known quality, known composition, could be used instead. And the intention was to prevent overdose, but also to help people to isolate, you know, and physically distance as well. So that was introduced as an temporary emergency measure. And I would say like around 2022, 2023, so that was the initial introduction. Then 2021, what was called a prescribed safe supply policy was introduced that was decoupled from COVID. So it was meant to continue. About 2023, there was a lot of uncertainty about kind of safer supply continuing, whether it was going to be canceled by the government. There was a lot of concern about prescriptions and the use of prescriptions. Some people believed, and you know, media played a big role in this, that prescriptions were causing overdose deaths, which isn't the case. You know, the evidence is that prescribed safe supply prevents overdose deaths. So there was a lot of uncertainty, a lot of kind of misinformation. And so the program, the number of prescriptions started going down, and not as many prescribers were prescribing. And that just kept happening until 2025, when it was announced that everyone getting prescribed safe supply would have to have their doses witnessed, which means they would have to go to a pharmacy probably 3 to 4 times a day, which you can imagine is just not feasible for people to work and to live their lives when you're having to be at the pharmacy every few hours.
When this policy was sort of contemporary, when it was playing out and unfolding, two of the biggest threads I recall reporting on it were, on the one hand, there were a number of people who were suggesting that this policy was not made available to a significant portion of the population of people affected by substance use disorder. And a lot of the people who raised that point were calling for this to be rolled out far more widely. Another common thread that you would see reported on were concerns around the idea of diversion, the idea that people would receive their prescription Dilaudid and then go and sell it to someone else. I'm wondering if you can speak to either of those two threads.
Yeah, I can probably speak, I think, to both of them. You know, we did some research early on, and prescribed safer supply was mainly available to people in urban centers. That's where the prescribers were, and where people could access. So really not very available in rural and remote communities, or in some cases, people and lots of examples of this is where people might travel 2 to 3 hours to a larger center to be able to access prescribed safe supply. So it wasn't very available. About 90% of safe supply initially was required daily pickups. So even if you were from out of town, you got a script, it still could mean that you had to come to the pharmacy every day, which in rural and remote communities might be quite limited, because sometimes the pharmacy hours are limited or they're not even open on the weekends. So there were a lot of difficulties accessing safe supply. And really right from the beginning, and I remember this early on, is, you know, people had to find a prescriber that was willing to prescribe. They had to, you know, not everyone was kind of automatically going to pick up and start prescribing safe supply, because it is, you know, it is a specialty. So that a lot of barriers. And then I think now adding the daily witnessing really limits and restricts it further.
And how about the idea that there were people who were receiving their safe supply and going in and selling it on the kind of black market, or going and selling it to other people?
Yeah, that really, really got blown out of proportion. And I, you know, I don't really know, to be honest, Joe, where that idea started. But, you know, there's always been examples of medications being shared by people. Often people, we can think about our own experiences of our of a parent or a grandparent who shared their medication, might be a pain med, you know, with someone because they were in pain and they needed it. And, you know, that we can talk about prescriptions not being used by the person that they're intended for. Most of the research shows that the amount of diversion is very low. When you look at seizure data from police, it's also a very small amount. And it's often very hard for police to know if something is an actual prescription or is it just a counterfeit prescription. We don't know these, like they can't necessarily know these things. So the amount of diversion is very low. It's always been very low. And I think, again, it's so easy because we live in such a stigmatized, criminalized world around drug use. It's so easy for these things to get either picked up and blown out of proportion or kind of used as targets by people who are maybe, you know, seeking personal or political gain in our system. And, you know, all of the research that I've been involved in and, you know, and I'm pretty aware of the other research around diversion and safer supply. And it's, you know, the amount is generally small and it's generally to help someone else.
We'll return to my conversation with Bernie Pauly with the Canadian Institute for Substance Use Research later on in the program. On Tuesday, in front of the legislature in Victoria, an event took place to mark the 10th anniversary of a public health emergency declaration in BC due to drug-related overdoses and deaths. In the crowd at that event, I spoke with Sarah Lee from Nanaimo, who's the treasurer with the Nanaimo Area Network of Drug Users, or NANDU for short. What is this day all about for you?
Loss. A lot of loss. 10 years ago, my partner died of carfentanil overdose, which was pretty much my first taste of this whole world. And since then, a lot of people have gone, more than I can count. Seems like every day you're finding out about somebody new. And I just want everybody to start thinking about how much it affects everybody and how little has been done so far.
What do you think the day-to-day is all about? Like, there are hundreds of people out there gathered. There are a lot of folks giving speeches. What are you hoping comes out of today's event, maybe for you and for everyone?
More knowledge about what's going on. I find a lot of people don't have a clue about what's going on. And some of them don't even know that there's an opioid crisis, which is completely blows my mind. I talked to a lady the other day who said she didn't know anything about why there were overdose prevention sites everywhere, and I was just like blown away. It was nuts. I couldn't believe it. So I just want more knowledge. I want people to know more about what's going on and how many people we've lost and why we've lost them and stuff like that.
Are there any things you find maybe like when you have a conversation like that, where do you start to try and talk about this?
Lots of the time I start to cry. I'm super emotional when it comes to this stuff. So I just ask them if they know anybody that's died and how it felt and if they wanted to do anything about it or if they could have done anything about it, would they want the help to do it? Because then they eventually realize that there's a lot more help that could be, like there's a lot more things that could be done to help what's going on. And it's even hard for me to talk about.
Thank you for being willing to talk.
Thank you. I kind of do a lot more behind the scenes things. So I don't really talk to too many people about everything that goes on. But everybody needs to know more. Everybody needs to know more. That's my only suggestion. More knowledge.
You mentioned you're the treasurer with a group called NANDU. Is there anything you can tell me about what NANDU is working on trying to do on this file?
Well, we had an overdose prevention site for a couple of years. We decided to shut down because the residential area that we were in was kind of having a bit of an issue with us being there. The city also deemed us a nuisance property, which was also a bit of an issue. So we shut that down, and we hold regular meetings for our general membership to come to, where we basically keep people in the loop about what's going on. We deliver more information as it comes out. We advocate for people. We're just there for people. A lot of the time I get phone calls just because people want to talk. People have lost somebody else or something like that. And we're there for people. We want everybody to know that there's somebody there for them, whether they're living in the lifestyle or losing somebody in their family because of the lifestyle. Just everybody needs to know that there's somebody there for them and that there's somebody fighting for them. That's pretty much, I think that's the goal of NANDU, to make everybody know that there's somebody there for them.
When this is, we talk about 10 years of the public health emergency, how have you seen things change or evolve in that time?
I haven't really seen much, except for the death toll go up. And it's getting more and more every year. Like the day we closed NANDU, there was an overdose right across the street that could have been prevented if we just kept our doors open. So it's really hard. Sorry.
Is there anything you think that people can do to help kind of move this forward?
Number one thing I would say is stop being so judgmental and stop with the stigmas and treat people like they're people, because sometimes that's all they need. I know that's all I needed when I was really heavy into the drug use. I just needed somebody to treat me like I was a real person and kind of drag me out of the ditch that I was in. And I met people at NANDU.
And were they able to do that?
Yeah. They were really, really big in turning my life around.
How would you say you're doing now?
I'm doing okay. I finally just got into stable housing after being homeless for over a year. I'm a lot healthier now. I have some really great friends, and I get to do stuff like this. So it's pretty cool. I couldn't have done it without NANDU.
Sarah Lee speaking with me Tuesday, April 14th at an event to mark the 10th anniversary of the declaration of a public health emergency in BC around toxic drug poisoning.
People First Radio and Media are Vancouver Island Mental Health Society education and awareness programs.
Bernie Pauly is a nursing professor at the University of Victoria. She's also a scientist with the Canadian Institute for Substance Use Research. On Tuesday, April 14th, I spoke with her about how the toxic drug crisis has unfolded over 10 years as a declared public health emergency in BC. Now in 2026, what do you feel like are the parts of this public health emergency that are either the most pressing, or maybe someone who, you know, learned about where this was at a few years ago and hasn't checked in a while? Like, what are the things you think are most contemporary to this at this moment, 10 years into the crisis?
I mean, the urgency, and it's how do we even talk about urgency after a decade? But there is that absolute urgency for scaling up evidence-based response and for moving to a regulated supply. And, you know, we have reports from the BC Coroner in 2023 that made a recommendation about immediately expanding medical and non-medical options for safer supply. That was, there was also a report in 2024 from the Office of the Provincial Public Health Officer that made recommendations about models of safer supply, but those were dismissed by government. They weren't implemented. So, the blueprints are there. The urgency, I guess I just don't understand how the urgency cannot be there when we have, you know, we've lost more than 18,000 people. Last year was 1,800, right? And that it's affecting families and community. And so I think the really important thing is to not become numb to this, and to continue to keep the urgency, continue to keep the pressure for evidence-based solutions and a regulated supply.
When you talk about a regulated supply, can you explain to me what you mean by that and what you see that looking like?
Yeah, so I think what was really important about the two reports I mentioned, the BC Coroner's Report and the Office of the Provincial Health Officer, is they did lay out how a non-medical form of prescribed safe supply programs could be operated through the province with appropriate controls and ensuring that quality substances are available. And I think, you know, we have to be careful because we don't have a lot of kind of examples or imagination about kind of how that could happen. But we can think about how at the provincial level, there could be a safe supply of substances that then could be distributed through programs throughout the province to people who are at risk of an overdose and who would meet a certain set of eligibility criteria and qualify to receive access to those programs.
So the idea being that if there is someone out there who has an addiction to fentanyl, that there would be a regulated way for them to access fentanyl.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would be. Or, I mean, obviously stimulants, some people are accessing stimulants. So we also need to make sure we have a focus on stimulants as well.
Do you think that's something that BC at the level of a provincial jurisdiction, BC would be able to go and do you think the federal government, for example, would be on board, or even international partners? Would there be significant pushback from something like the United States, et cetera?
I mean, I think it's a very, I mean, we have to remember, we've got a lot of firsts here in BC. First to call a public health emergency, first to introduce, you know, overdose prevention sites, provincial level policies around safer supply. Even though we attempted, Decrim was attempted it and failed, I think that it's a very, you know, and like I said, the blueprint is there, particularly in the 2023 BC Coroner's Report, to say how that could actually happen. But it actually is going to take the communities demanding it, people understanding what it means, along with the political will to do it. Because, you know, I think if we've learned anything from kind of the Decrim pilot is how easy it is to subvert, you know, programs by just bringing in these narratives of criminalization.
Well, we've talked about a few of the ways that the policy response to this over the last decade has unfolded. You've talked about the decriminalization pilot that has since wrapped up. You've talked about the idea of prescribed alternatives or safer supply that was rolled out and then sort of scaled back and changed to this witness dosing model. Behind some of those seem to be a sort of a public opinion, a shift in the winds or a backlash, if that's fair to say. How do you see that evolving? Do you see that evolving? Where do you see this kind of going?
Yeah, I mean, we are in a period of backlash against harm reduction and a rise in kind of ideology that supports criminalizing people. And I think a question is, what is it going to take to turn the tide, to say, to really say, we do understand this as a health issue? You know, the BC Commissioner on Human Rights put out a report highlighting how the lack of responses to the toxic drug supply and the connection to human rights and the violation of human rights. And so is that going to be what needs to happen, is to say, actually, our responses right now are violating human rights. And I think that's something that, you know, will it become before the courts? Will that be kind of where it's going to go next? Because something has to shift. And at the same time, is there a growing number of people who've got access to information, you know, through accurate information, through the media, through understanding the research, to recognize that there are evidence-based solutions and we can do a comprehensive response? We just need all levels of government to come on and support that.
Well, is it fair to say that there's sort of a glaring contradiction at the level of the fact that there has been this declared public health emergency for a decade, and everyone is sort of aware that people are dying every single day from toxic drugs, and you have a number of people saying this is a health problem, and we also have this system of the substances that everyone really essentially knows it's kind of out in the open that they are being bought and sold and used every day are criminalized, and there is this entire legal system also set up to deal with that, and neither the sort of criminal justice or enforcement response or this attitude of this is a public health emergency, this is a health problem, neither of those seems to be being acted upon to its like full extent. Does that make sense? Is there that kind of glaring contradiction in how we respond to this on a kind of societal or government level?
I think with the public health emergency, the concern is do we now have an emergency in name only, right? And where are the responses? I think that's really, and are we becoming numb to this? And, you know, I think a really important aspect of the 10th year and the declaration and the recognition and the marking of that event is to say it's unacceptable. The number of deaths is unacceptable. And we have evidence-based solutions and we can do better and actually put action to the public health response to an emergency. So we should really, we really can take this moment and say, that's what we need to do. And we need to do it now and not rely on criminalization and drug law enforcement, because that's never going to get us out of this.
Is there anything else you think it's important to highlight on this 10th anniversary of this public health emergency declaration?
I have one thing that I want to highlight. And it really is the human toll that this takes. When we think of 18,000 people in this province, when someone dies of an overdose, it's a sudden death. It's unintended. It's often unexpected in many cases. And so when I think of all those people that are impacted and the people who are working front lines, in many of the harm reduction services, they're impacted too. And they're losing their family, they're losing their friends. And, they're losing people potentially that they work with. And I think that amount of loss and grief, we really need to acknowledge the work that the frontline workers are doing. And when I say frontline workers, I mean people who are working in harm reduction services, people, you know, who are providing peer-to-peer services. And think of also as part of it is how do we provide support for them and hold them up for the incredible job that they're doing. And then one other thing I think is that we don't talk about very much is like health promotion, upstream kind of education, and the important role of that, particularly with youth and youth in schools, and how we, you know, youth are smart. You can't just say no. That has been shown not to work. But, you know, upstream prevention programs for youth as well.
Oh, what do you think are the ways to work on that upstream prevention for youth? What do you think is the message that youth need to hear about this? Or what do you think are the things we need to be doing to create environments conducive to youth having a chance to not fall victim to toxic drugs?
Yeah. So one thing I think about is that there are drug education programs that have been developed and are available that are based on accurate information about substances. They're based on making choices and recognizing, you know, what those choices are and what the impact of those choices might be. So that's really an important kind of development in drug education. The other thing I think of, though, is also around the availability of mental health services related to trauma counseling, also probably pain management, because life events happen and people are experiencing a lot of stress. They might have an injury, they're experiencing pain, they have gone through things that are very traumatizing. And those are situations in which people might turn to substances as a way to cope. So having those kinds of services can be both preventive and can also be part of recovery as well.
Bernie Pauly is a scientist with the Canadian Institute for Substance Use Research and a professor of nursing at the University of Victoria. That's all the time we have for the program today. You've been listening to People First Radio. I'm Joe Pugh. Thank you very much for tuning in. I hope you can join me again next week.
People First Radio is a community media project of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society and produced in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed do not necessarily represent the views of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society or its broadcast partners.